From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
It's you. My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. Gentlemen, I propose that we skip the Twitter roll call for now. I just want to check in with you all. How's it going in our respective bunkers?
It's going okay. Family time has been great. I have to say, we're reaching the point now in this saga, this situation, where more and more of us, at least me personally, are knowing people, like a direct, I have a direct relationship with several people who now have, or believe to have come down with COVID-19. And, I would say while a lot of this downtime being at the house has been pretty great to get things done, to be with family and everything, it feels like it's closing in a little more at this point. That's just maybe personal feeling, but that's where I'm at.
Quick question. Have the people that you suspect to have contracted the coronavirus, have they been able to obtain tests? Because those things are pretty much unicorns in this country.
Not a single one. 0 out of 6.
That's a shame. I wish them a speedy recovery, man.
Yeah, the good thing is that of all the people I know, 4 out of 6 have fully recovered at this point. So that's at least a very good sign.
That's fantastic news. What about you, Noel? I mean, you and I spoke earlier today, but how's it going?
It's good. I'm okay. I had my daughter this weekend, and I just brought her back to her mom's this morning. We had a nice weekend. We're kind of shuffling her back and forth. I'm obviously continuing to work, so it's easier for her mom, who is not working, to do the homeschool situation. She does have a small child as well, so she's having to balance that. My daughter's sister, but it's good. I've been doing a lot of things that I don't normally do, being home all the time. I've talked about, working on music and reading and just catching up on things and catching up with a lot of old friends, doing some online gaming. If anybody wants to online game, you can hit me up. I'm all about it. I've been playing Borderlands 3. I wanted to share something really quick that I haven't told you guys about. I had a listener reach out to me on Instagram, talking about how, thanking us basically for, the show and the continuity of the show. He's a fan of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know and also Movie Crush. And he said that he was dealing with the coronavirus, that he actually got the virus. I asked him a little bit more information, and he said he's a patient transport person, an ambulance driver, I assume, in Long Island. He could trace back to exactly when he was exposed because his supervisors were able to isolate the incident, that the patient that he was transporting, and go back and kind of do process of elimination. So he could figure out when he was exposed. He was exposed on like the 13th and didn't start experiencing symptoms till last week, early last week, which that was kind of interesting to me, because that seems like an awful long time. The good news is he's in his late 20s. He's running a fever of about 100.4, and it continues. So it's not just like it spikes and goes away. So that's certainly a thing that you can look for. And he seems to be doing okay. He's just taking Tylenol, and he is in the hospital. I think that's largely to do with his profession, and just playing it safe. And he said he's got nurses that are checking in on him. It was really nice that he reached out to let him know that the show was helping him sleep and just kind of keeping him calm, and also to get a little information directly from someone that was dealing with it. So I'm going to keep his name anonymous, but he said it was okay to share this.
Agreed. Yeah. And thanks for sharing that on air. Peek behind the curtain here, conspiracy realist. We've been doing the same thing, or at least I've been, Matt, Noel, and I have been, I've been sending you guys text messages where I've been screen capping some similar communications, Thank you to everybody who's been reaching out to us to thank us, and even more importantly, to encourage us to keep going, even when the circumstances are fraught with plot twists. Like these are troubled days. So we're here for you. You can find us as a group. You can also find us as individuals, and you can find our good pal Noel on, what'd you say, Borderlands?
I'm on Borderlands. You can find me at The Cubists, T-H-E-C-U-B-I-S-T-S, if you want to hit me up and do a little gaming. I've been connecting with some listeners and playing some Borderlands. Quick, huge thanks to this listener because, you know, very much on the front lines of this pandemic, putting himself in harm's way, and obviously is dealing with the repercussions of that, but something that clearly he does not regret, and it's very much a mission that keeps this person kind of going. So I really, really appreciated the information, and also just really respect you being willing to put yourself out there and not really think of yourself instead of thinking of others first, you know?
Yes, big ups indeed. And to everybody else who's putting their health and lives on the line to save and protect everybody else.
Yeah, we've been including that message, but we simply cannot overstate it enough. And also, you know, in the interest of privacy, I've just been sending these messages to Matt and Noel offline. But if you are okay with us sharing your story on air, please just let us know in the message and let us know if you wish to remain anonymous or if you wish to have your name or a name attached to your story. There is no right or wrong answer here. But today's episode is not about COVID, ostensibly, or not yet. Today, we are returning to the Korean Peninsula. This is not an episode about my ongoing obsession with the infamous Hermit Kingdom of North Korea, or our collective obsession now. In fact, this, in a way, is a pop culture episode. You see, we're delving into the global phenomena collectively known as K-pop or Korean pop music. So here are the facts. First, what is K-pop? It's what it sounds like. It's a collective term for pop music originating in South Korea, and it may surprise some of our fellow listeners to learn just how recent this phenomena is.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, today's K-pop industry wouldn't exist at all without South Korea's extensive modernization and a crucial detail, their relaxation of censorship, particularly in the way this change has affected the nation's ability to broadcast things on television. Because back in the day, before some of the reforms took place in 1987 that created the nation's sixth republic, there were only two broadcast networks in the entire country. And they had just immense control over the kind of music South Koreans were allowed to listen to. The radio was also more or less under state control.
Yeah. Think about all those times you've heard people older than you, maybe your parents, maybe your, some other loved ones say, you know, back in my day, the television only had like three channels, UHF, VHF, whatever. And then you just had to watch what was on channel 3 or 5 or 11 or whatever it was in their part of the world. This was the situation in South Korea. This is not an exaggeration. Also, like you said, radio is under a government control. This means that if we're being incredibly diplomatic, we would say independent music didn't have much of a footprint, by which we mean like zero. These folks were very much a state enterprise. Rock and roll music, as we think of it today, or even back then, was incredibly controversial. It was often banned, sometimes for almost xenophobic reasons. The idea that the culture of the Korean nation would be compromised by a glut of this foreign music. And the way there was a specific way that musicians and songs met the public. There were these talent shows on television. They aired on the weekends. And again, remember, there were only like two channels. And when performers won these talent shows, then radio would play their music finally, but they would only play the music of the people who had already, you know, quote unquote, made it on those weekend TV shows. So there was no like underground breakout star who went from busking on the streets of Seoul to all of a sudden blowing up on your radio station.
You know, it's interesting, like J-pop, which is the Japanese equivalent of K-pop, obviously, really didn't hit big until the 90s either. But Japan had much more of a history of like more diverse kind of musical tastes, especially after, you know, global conflicts and a lot of American soldiers bringing, you know, American music to Japan. And then, you know, when Japan kind of became this almost like had to rebuild from the ashes, you know, of being bombed, they kind of emerged as this like technological superpower and this very pop culture driven society. So that was much earlier, obviously, than K-pop. But very interesting that the boy band, girl group kind of thing didn't really come around until the 90s, around the same time that K-pop was happening.
Yeah, because it's so easy, going back to our earlier ongoing conversation for longtime listeners, it's so easy to forget that this is kind of a new thing in the grand scheme of events. It seems like it's always been around, but it's really, it goes down to that 1987 Reformation. That's when the soil was laid for this. So after things are loosened up, after they're a little bit less Orwellian with censorship, radio blows up. Radio is everywhere AF, or I should say AM/FM. South Korean residents would hear new music that they had never heard before. They'd hear it on a regular basis. It's like, just for a second, every radio station became 88.5 or 91.1. Those are two great, great local stations here in Atlanta. It's like everything turned to college radio in terms of the variety you would see. And this included music from the Yankees, music from the United States. So people were digging it and they were like, hey, this isn't that bad. But radio is only part of the story, right?
Yeah, don't forget those talent shows. Those come back in a big and important way for new acts and new types of music. I mean, TV is really the gold standard. It had been in South Korea, and it continued to be that way. More than 99% of the homes in South Korea had access to national television networks as early as 1992. So that's not long after the change over there. And then people watching TV, it was the most viewership that had ever existed within South Korea, especially on the weekends. And that's when those talent shows happen. And that is where you get all these new acts being introduced to everybody in South Korea all at once.
Yeah. And these TV shows still, even now, remain in the modern day one of the biggest single factors in the success of any South Korean band. It's funny because, you know, I know that all of us, all four of us, Mission Control, Matt, Noel, and myself, we're fans of music history, both from a sociocultural perspective and just from the experience of music we like. So we all know that when you look at a genre or a shift in music, you tend to look more at a gradient, right? A lot of genres kind of blend and slowly evolve into something new or different. But unlike many musical genres, K-pop appears to have a definitive starting point. It's April 11th, 1992. There's a great account of this by a researcher named Hannah Waite. She studies the history of K-pop, and she says that a group named Seo Taiji, pardon me if I'm mispronouncing, Seo Taiji and Boys, they are the watershed moment of K-pop. So Seo Taiji is the front man of a couple different bands. First, he was in a heavy metal band called Senoue, and they broke up. He got into hip-hop. He teamed up with two dancers. They performed a single called Nan Areo, or I Know, on one of these weekend talent shows you were talking about, Matt. And boom, just like that, when they perform on April 11th, 1992, K-pop is born. This may make you think that Seo Taiji and the Boys actually won the competition. But
no, man, they came out on the bottom. You got the lowest score on anybody on the show that day. But it doesn't matter. I'm trying to imagine what it's like. I'm going to take it to my 4-year-old son. So he had never tried broccoli before. And then one day he tried it and he didn't like it at all. He's like, ugh, that is gross. But now he knows what broccoli is. And when we talk about broccoli, He thinks about it, and he'll take a taste. He's like, it's okay. And now broccoli is one of his favorite things that he can eat. I'm telling you, that's all that they needed. They needed to just get that broccoli on TV for a second.
It reminds me of like that Do You Want to Be a VJ competition where that like super skinny, weird looking stoner guy, Jesse, won first place. And the guy that won runner up ended up ultimately becoming a pretty big television sensation. Like, yeah, had much more of a, you know, long lasting career in TV, whereas Jesse kind of burned out pretty quickly. I mean, he already seemed like a bit of a burnout. He had like some issues with drugs and alcohol and like, you know, being on the lam about, I don't know, it was a whole thing. But that guy, Dave, what was Dave's last name? He lost the competition, but he ultimately came out on top.
Dave Coulier.
It wasn't Coulier. It wasn't Mustaine. It wasn't Navarro. It was the Dave.
Well, if you're talking Dave's on top, I'm always thinking of Dave Coulier. I mean, that's the gold standard of Dave's, right?
Welcome to MTV News. This is Dave Holmes.
Dave Holmes.
There we go.
That's exactly right.
He's an acceptable Dave substitute. I agree. Man, VJ, that was a dream job, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point there is that the whole South Korean culture got introduced to this K-pop thing all of a sudden, all at once, and they all saw it, and they went, huh, that's a thing. It's not our favorite, but it's a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here's what happens. So there's an interesting role here in, you know, there's something to be said about the possibility of cultural policing. You know, like in France, there is an official linguistic institute that monitors how new words are entering the French language, and they're fighting to quote unquote preserve it. You have to ask yourself whether the judges on this talent show were playing CEO and the boys to the left because they were too culturally different. One thing's for sure. The rest of the nation does not agree with the judges. This song, I Know, goes on to dominate the singles charts of South Korea for like 17 weeks. And then for 15 years after that, it remained, it held the record for the number one longest streak in the country's history, or the longest time at number one.
Yeah, and this was not just like a band. This was like the beginnings of an institution, and big business recognized that. Recording studios, record labels actually stepped in to take over and formed a new studio system.
Saw dollars. Yeah.
When we say studio system, we think of like MGM, Universal, you know, like the big movie studios. This is that kind of money and that kind of opportunity. They created this from scratch out of the ashes of the broadcast-centered system, right? So then between 95 and 98, you had three mega powerhouse music studios appearing. You had SM Entertainment, often just referred to as SM Town, and that was in 95. And then we have JYP Entertainment in 97 and YG Entertainment in 98, created by one of the members of Seo Taiji and Boys. And then we've got, that was Young Hyun Suk. And so together, these studios began to cultivate and headhunt, essentially, recruit what would become known as idol groups. And, you know, we know this in the States in terms of like the Backstreet Boys and as far back as the New Kids on the Block and, you know, more recently with One Direction and these kind of super groups, even as far back as the Monkees, you know, bands that were built from the ground up by executives for the purposes of eliciting a certain response. It wasn't like they were just doing it in their parents' garage. These were created as a business ploy.
Can we pause here really quickly just to talk about how big this business has become? Because we're talking about the first big three, right?
Right.
SM Entertainment, JYP Entertainment, and YG Entertainment.
Yeah.
So these are the big ones. It's the mid-90s to the late 90s when these are created. If you look now at lists anywhere of the biggest K-pop groups that are out there, and there are so many groups that exist, almost... Not this isn't all of the music labels that are controlling all of them, but JYP is still up there. SM is still up there. YG is still up there. Now you've got Big Hit Entertainment, KQ Entertainment, Cube Entertainment, FNC Entertainment, and there are probably a dozen more that control I don't even know how many hundreds of groups. It's crazy.
Here's the thing. A lot of those younger studios are kind of a revolving door, like we see with government and private industry in the United States, because a lot of their creators were formerly members of K-pop groups or somehow affiliated with the industry and struck out on their own. I do want to point out also, when we say idol group, we mean IDOL. These folks are anything but IDLE. They're actually living a very, very difficult life. The first idol group comes on the global stage in 1996. The founder of SM, a guy named Lee Soo-man, creates this group called HOT, H-O-T, and he does it by getting five singers and dancers who, in his mind, represent what he thinks teens want to see from a pop group. So, you know, I love that Monkees reference, because it's just like somebody who's kind of aged out of that scene going, you know what the young folks like? You know, they like a little gyrate. They like a gyrate with a hip, and they like a little, they like a little harmony.
This is what the kids are bopping to these days.
Well, they like these Beatles, and we need to make more of those. We'll just call them the Monkees.
But what's funny about the Monkees is they started off that way, and then they made some pretty cool records and a really psychedelic film called Head that you guys should check out if you haven't seen it. Like, they actually went on to be pretty interesting in their own right. But that was a thing that took the world by storm. I have a question. Like, maybe we're going to get to this, but
I just want to say I love Red Rubber Ball. Everyone should listen to it when you get a chance.
That's a good I think so. It's a good vocal warm-up, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
isn't that
one
that's hard to say?
I really thought that was an H.O.T. song.
What is H.O.T.?
Well, what's your question?
I mean, they're called idol bands. That's obviously where the American Idol came from. It was emulating this system of talent shows that was so huge that created this industry, right?
Yeah. 100% agreed. And that means that we can also trace the evolution of all the other kind of shows like America's Got Talent and whatever their derivatives are. We can trace all of that to this genre. So now we have the emergence of the idol group, the emergence of these huge Leviathan size businesses, and it's off to the races. Nowadays, the global invasion of K-pop is part of a larger cultural invasion called Hallyu, or the Korean wave. But Matt, I really like something you pointed out. How big of a business are we talking? We'll explore that briefly after a word from our sponsor. Okay, we're back. How big of a business? Well, it's global, that's for sure. That's an understatement of stuff they don't want you to know history. Because today, the popularity of K-pop, not just Hallyu, but specifically K-pop, reaches far, far, far beyond the South Korean borders. There was a survey conducted in 2019 where they asked a ton of people in 17 different countries, what's the word on K-pop in your neck of the global woods? And 37.5% of everybody responding in all 17 countries said that K-pop was super popular in their country. And think about that. Because not everybody in those 17 different countries speaks Korean, right? Or reads Korean. The fans are almost their own episode. The fans of K-pop are rabid. They are fanatically loyal. They're found across the planet. And there are even some what are called anti-fans. Have you guys heard about this? The anti-fans who, for one reason or another, specifically zone in and hate a K-pop band or a performer, sometimes because they feel like that person is has done something wrong to a K-pop performer that they like. It's very weird. Like, this is a graphic thing, but the level of stalking here has entered like Fatal Attraction, Cape Fear degrees of extremes. Not to be too crass, but fans have in the past sent letters proclaiming their undying love to, again, people they've never met, but these letters have been written in blood, particularly menstrual blood.
What?
In at least a few cases. Yeah.
Ooh. Okay.
Well, they'll even go so far as to set up cameras and mics in the hotel rooms of traveling musicians, as these bands, as they're going around, they'll like show up early and basically bug the rooms before the band gets there and then just record them and put right. out videos.
Now, I think I may have mentioned this to you, Ben, but when I got back from a trip not too long ago, in the gate at the Atlanta Hartsfield Jackson Airport, there was a group of what appeared to be Japanese or Korean school-aged girls, and they were wearing, you know, the traditional kind of school garb, like a skirt and kind of like a uniform top, and they were all wearing masks, so I couldn't quite tell what their nationality was, and I was also from afar, but they all had these very pricey-looking telephoto lenses and were all just snappity-snapping it up at these four dudes hanging out in the corner, looking on their phones. I believe they had to have either been J or K-pop dudes, but I'm like, how are these young ladies happen to be traveling with them, or what's the deal? Like, are they following them around the country? Like, it's a, yeah. is that a thing? Like, what's up?
Oh yeah. Yeah. In fact, the communication network for fan groups is extensive. They could probably teach intelligence agencies a few things, to be candid. I'll never forget, I was spending some time in Koreatown in Tokyo, and we saw something kind of the same thing, just sitting, getting like a matcha tea or whatever kind of coffee house confection. And then all of a sudden there was this mob of people with, as you said, very expensive professional grade telephoto lenses, and they were waiting for these people who literally just sort of like walked by nonchalantly. Maybe one guy posed, and it was nuts to see that up close. It was almost like how whale hunters or whale watchers must feel when they're out in the boat and all of a sudden they see this enormous thing rising from the depths. It's a huge industry. And you know, just to give some numbers about how big this is, we were talking about this off air. The true financial numbers, especially for those big three studios, are a little squirrely, at least in my opinion. I honestly think they're being underreported, but you can find some estimates. But as we're going to learn, those estimates leave something to be desired. We can talk about some specific global milestones that K-pop has reached. You'll recall the first YouTube video to reach 1 billion views. Everybody remember what that one was?
Was it Gangnam Style?
It was the very same, by Psy, who's interesting because he's not like your typical K-pop person in appearance. But yeah, he reached 1 billion views. And as we record, the numbers continue to climb for just that one video.
Well, first of all, that must have had something to do with the fact that that was one of the first ones to really hit big in America.
I think so. Yeah, I agree.
Because it was huge in America, and it was mainly because it was just funny. It was a really, really funny video. It was really brilliantly produced with all the dance moves and like all the crazy pyrotechnics, but it had this tongue-in-cheekness to it that I think really just hit at the time where like absurdist comedy was really big, like Tim and Eric and things like that. So I think that fascination with some of these, you know, cultural phenomenons and then being able to kind of glom on to the sort of absurdity of it all really made it go over the top, because that was the first ever K-pop thing that I was ever really intimately familiar with, and I don't know that there's ever been another one since then that I was as familiar with.
Well, here, yeah, I would agree, but let's imagine really quickly how much is that worth, 1 billion views on YouTube? Now, just from our experience on YouTube, you know, that's probably a fairly large, that's a nice chunk of money, but you know, it's YouTube money. It's, you know, it's okay, but that's not going to make anybody a millionaire necessarily. Even if you did that a bunch of times, you might get there eventually. And then think about album sales now in, let's say, 2020 and even the 2010s. Album sales aren't what they used to be, because streaming became such a thing, and you have to imagine how much money is actually being generated by a Psy or by the biggest K-pop band out there right now.
Ah, interesting you say that. I would like to quote Spaceballs or any number of Danny DeVito, Frank Reynolds subplots and Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's merchandising. You know what I mean? That's where a lot of the money is. Like, that's a great point, Matt. Let's talk Turkey. Believe it or not, as of 2019, a single K-pop band, and let's see, fellow listeners, fellow conspiracy realists, let's see if you can guess who it is while you're listening along at home. A single K-pop band is worth an estimated $4.65 billion US.
Wow.
Can you guess? I bet you guys already know.
I think it's probably, what is it, EXO?
Close. It is it is what appears to be a short grouping of English letters. It's BTS, the elephant in the room of K-pop whenever we talk about it. BTS was also the first K-pop group to reach number one on the Billboard charts. They also still hold the record for the best-selling album in all of South Korean history from like since the first album came out in South Korea ever.
Wow. Wow. You know, I only learned about them when they went on Saturday Night Live. But they were pretty great performers. That's all I really know about them.
They're a little bit different. K-pop fans have assured me because in a lot of performances, you might hear that some K-pop bands are lip syncing their songs, but BTS is famous for always actually singing the songs. And you know what? Even if you're not a fan, you got to respect the hustle. You got to respect those dance moves. Those guys have it on lock. They're on point. Now, they also performed live in front of a million people in person in Times Square in December of 2019, ringing in the new year, and 1 billion other people tuned in via television. Those numbers are insane. We could dedicate an entire podcast series, not just the show, a series to K-pop alone, and doubtlessly many other podcasts have, but we just wanted to articulate the broad strokes. We wanted to give you the lay of the land. K-pop is successful. It's huge. It is a global economic force all its own. But we would be remiss if we didn't have just like a little fun with this. So we've named EXO, we've named Psy, we've named BTS, and we've named the group that made the first K-pop appearance back there in April. But let's see, Matt, you found some other names that you wanted to share with us, huh?
Yeah, let's do this. I just looked up couple lists of what would be considered the top-selling or most popular K-pop groups that are out there right now as of, I think, 7 days ago. So here are some. Blackpink, GOT7, Stray Kids, Twice, TXT, Red Velvet, NCT 127, 17, Mamamoo, Icon,
with a K,
Monsta X, ATEEZ, Super M, Astro, Giddle, or is it G Idol?
I think it's G Idol. I'm not the authority there.
Anyway, there's a ton. Pentagon, Day 6, X1, One Us, A-Pink, XP Edition. There's just so many.
Yeah, there's so many, and you picked some great ones. I am sorry to inform all our fellow listeners that Stray Kids and Twice are two different bands. For some reason, I love the idea of a band that's just named Stray Kids Twice.
Me too. they're so wonderful. I love all those names. It's so much fun. It just feels like screen names to me. Right. Weird screen names.
Remember when everything used to be surrounded by like X's, like lowercase and lowercase X, then the uppercase X? It wasn't that a straight edge thing for a while?
It was in some circles, yeah. Like people would draw X's or even tattoo X's on their flesh. This is interesting because these bands, we have to emphasize, it's not just about the music. There's the fashion, there's the tone, there's of course the merchandising. But this is not all that K-pop is. And it's tragic and it's unfortunate that we have to say that. It's the point of our episode today because K-pop is not all cutting-edge fashion, smiling teens, and scads of money minted from catchy love songs that are written to algorithm. K-pop, you see, has a dark side. And we're diving in after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy.
Yeah, it turns out there's a very dark side to this business. And in a lot of ways, what we're going to be talking about ahead reflects some of the issues that we've talked about before in the music industry, just globally, as well as entertainment industries across the world, especially in Hollywood and in the United States. But it's a very own brand of dark side. Just a word of warning coming up. This will make some of you uncomfortable. We're going to be talking about allegations of abuse, sexual and otherwise. Just a word of warning. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Yep. For the past several years, decades, really, K-pop has encountered a number of scandals and then a greater number of suppressed or hush-hush scandals that give lie to the squeaky clean image the bands and their management work so hard to project to the outside world. Here are just a few. We wanted to isolate some broad categories of issues. The first, okay, so we mentioned one band alone, BTS, is a multi-billion dollar industry by itself. That's a very extreme example, but there's no arguing that a lot of these bands make a ton of money. And that's our first question. That's our first issue. Who actually gets that revenue? Who gets the money? The answer might surprise you.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, we're going to see some parallels with this and the way artists are treated in the States, too. This is a much more egregious version of this. Performers sign contracts that can last as long as 15 years. That's insane. We definitely don't see terms of that length in the United States.
And just to give you an idea of that, the terms are somewhere between 7 and 15 years, the ones that at least I've come across. And when you're talking about a talent contract or something like that, terms, yeah, that, as Noel is saying, that's an exorbitant amount of time. Terms are usually in the year to, you know, a couple of years, 5 years maybe maximum, but that's a lot.
Yeah, that's essentially like signing away your adolescence to a company. And that goes along with the profit ratios as well. We're looking at 80% ceded to the company, 20% to the artists, or 90% to the company and 10% to the artists. So it's like almost like a form of indentured servitude.
Absolutely. And keep in mind that if you are in a group, that figure is even worse for you because that 10 or 20% is typically going to be split between you and all your band members. This is important because those 7 to 15 year contracts aren't just like put out X amount of albums, do live shows as requested and appearances. They're things like morality clauses, incredibly strict rules on your public interaction, even your private interaction. And this does function at its worst as indentured servitude. They've actually been called slave contracts because it's meant to keep the performers entirely dependent on their label owners, because the way that these groups are created is very competitive and people train in groups for just a chance to be in a K-pop outfit. So you know, as an individual performer, in many cases, that if you don't toe the line, there are hundreds of people right behind you who will jump at an even worse deal.
And just to really expand on that for a second, in a lot of the reporting about this, and I don't know the full reality of it, but certainly from the reporting, the training that occurs just to essentially be auditioned at some point or to be like a stand-in to get into one of these groups, if a member leaves or something, you are training for literally 10 years before you become a member of one of these major groups, if you're going through some of the big, you know, the big schools, essentially, the K-pop schools that exist out there.
Well, that means they're starting you off when you're very, very young then, right?
a lot of times. Other times, the ages range pretty extensively there. But I would say, yes, starting out young and going through the system to then hopefully one day get one of those contracts. And when you get into a group, I don't know if you've noticed this, but the K-pop groups range from 2 people to generally about 5 to 7 people and go up to in the dozen. Dozen, like literally a dozen people in one group. And we're talking about splitting that money, you know, 20% to maybe 10%. That's so intense, Ben.
Yeah. And it depends on what the, you know, is that 10 or 20% that's stated on paper? Is that the actual percentage of the haul? Color me skeptical or color me cynical. But here's another thing about that age range question. Yes, starting early is advantageous because there is one big difference between this type of music industry and the pop industry here in the United States. Well, there are many differences, but here's one a lot of people don't think about. These groups often have kind of hardwired expiration dates or breakup dates because the Republic of Korea, South Korea, has mandatory military service. That means that you are already on a ticking clock leading up to the time in which you must enlist. And that means that you have a very limited window of time to make it big. And you also don't have a huge opportunity to fight back against this system if you want to, you know, get better representation or make things better for performers overall. It's brilliant in the way that it has been calculated. But unfortunately, no, like that's bad. That's terrible. But, you know, we can't cast too much aspersion because that's the music industry across the world over. There's another problem, which is unfortunately shared with many other countries' music industries, and that is sexual abuse. Sexual abuse in a couple of different ways. One of the most famous examples is something called the Burning Sun scandal. This happened about a year ago this month. There were several male K-pop stars, including a guy named Seungri. And again, we don't speak Korean. Here's what you need to know about him. He was a member of a boy band named Big Bang. And he and one of his associates, he and a couple of his associates, a former member of a group called FT Island, and a singer and songwriter called Jung Jun Young, were implicated in a spy cam sexual abuse scandal. The songwriter was sharing videos of women filmed without their consent in a group chat. And when we say without their consent, this isn't, you know, this is all terrible, but it's not like they weren't just filming people naked or exposed without their consent. They were filming gang sexual assault on women who had been drugged, women who had been plied with drink and were unconscious or unresponsive. This is demonic stuff. Jeez. And then, yeah. And then it turns out it's called Burning Sun scandal because Seungri had ties to a nightclub called Burning Sun. And that's where a lot of this sexual assault took place. The three men involved got 5 and 6 year prison sentences, but the controversy there is, first off, is that a fair sentence? You know, were the was their massive popularity somehow swaying the public toward giving them a lighter sentence? And that leads us to something else too, which is that there are proving cases where K-pop stars have been more or less forced to sleep with powerful people in the industry, either to advance their own career, they're sleeping with someone in a position of power, or a person in position of power tells them to go sleep with someone else and they're sent out. This is forced sex work, and it happens. It's happening.
Yeah, according to BBC News, this is an issue that runs pretty rampant within the industry, where there are these clubs like Burning Sun that exist all over the place where the K-pop stars will go to make appearances and those kinds of things. And then because of those contracts, there's this pressure that's felt to just go and do whatever you are told to do. And oftentimes it is exactly what Ben described. again, that's BBC News. That's not, you know, some other reporting agency that, you know, is fairly unknown making allegations. This is BBC News actually doing some digging into this.
Mm-hmm. And this tragic situation combined with the terrible issues with the contracts and the financial, the opportunity for financial corruption, those two alone would be enough to be a horrific episode, but it doesn't stop there. There are a couple of other things we need to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, think about what it must feel like to be kind of bred almost to be this squeaky clean image. Not only that, you know, of pop music and of like, you know, good times, but very, very G-rated kind of, and also sort of an ambassador for your country. There were some folks, men and women alike, who have just buckled under the strain of these brutal schedules, rehearsals, regiments, and just the expectation. We've got a story about Kim Jong-hyun, who's 27, who is a member of SHINee. He took his own life in 2017 after talking about how intense this pressure was. And of course, you know, you think of people having extreme success and everything being easy street, but think about the pressure and anxiety of losing everything. And I'm sure this is something that we've seen is wielded by some of those handlers, right? And then we've got another one in October of 2019.
Yes, this in October 2019, Su Lee, 25-year-old, she's a former member of the girl group FX. She also took her own life. And then just a month later, a woman named Guhara, who was in a group called Kara, and then she was also a solo performer, she took her own life, and she actually was a close friend of Su Lee. So the two of them in 2 months, 25 and 28, both took their lives.
Tragedy. Tragedy. And they're not the only examples. You can see, you know, to your point, Noel, you can see how unsustainable and demanding it could be to literally have this contract that says you have to be perfect. You know, you can't do a lot of the things that normal kids do when they're teenagers or in their 20s, you know, like dating, maybe having a long-term relationship, maybe even pursuing kids. You have to be this 24/7 advertisement, you know, and that's just not how people are built to live.
Well, and if you're a female, you also have to essentially starve yourself, especially in this system, because there's reporting on this, and it's just to keep that ideal image. It's not, you know, not only the ideal image outwardly as far as your actions, it's what you look like. And there's also a massive problem with plastic surgery, where young people are getting plastic surgery to look a very specific way to meet these standards. And there are several alleged, let's say, cases where that plastic surgery was not the choice of the individual. It was the choice of the, you know, the controlling members of that, the group, the company, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I want to point out one thing that many of us might not know is that South Korea actually has the highest rate of plastic surgery per capita in the world. And the most popular surgeries are things like skin whitening, nose jobs, and it's called double eyelid surgery. That's where they change the state of your epicanthic fold. And it's all to make these people more closely resemble this kind of idealized physical image. You know what I mean? Even if it's unrealistic.
And Ben, I wanted to bring this up because we're touching on it here. Noel, you're talking about kind of that G-rated lifestyle, or, you know, that state of perfection where you can't be seen to be doing anything wrong in public, right? And yet, both males, but especially females in K-pop, are overtly sexualized, like so overtly sexualized. And that's not completely across the board, but I would estimate 90% of the groups are overly sexualized. both in, you know, clothing that's being worn and in choreography, especially, and the way that they are seen by the camera, you know, the gaze of the camera. So there's this kind of, I don't know what you call it, this balancing act there between these perfect G-rated people, yeah, but then also like the way they're portrayed.
You're absolutely right, man. You see what I was getting at there, right? Like, it's almost like there's this squeaky clean image. Like, the sexualization is almost innuendo, you know what I mean? Like, you would never actually think of them having sex or being sexual beings who are in control. They're just objects. They're sort of like anime characters or something like that, that are kind of trotted out and there's no humanity to them. You know, that's the way they're portrayed, kind of.
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's just, it reminds me of somebody like Britney Spears that had that similar thing. Like, if you remember when she was first becoming popular and she's portrayed as this schoolgirl in this very innocent way and yet hypersexualized. Mm-hmm. So it's just, we're talking about all these issues here, and you can just almost feel how the portrayal on camera, I think, a lot of times ends up being one of these major issues where there's a disconnect between what's being seen by the end user, somebody at their house, you know, watching one of these videos. There's such a disconnect between that image that's being seen and then the actual human being that is attempting to function within this system.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. I think we're all in agreement here. One terrifying aspect of this we have to point out is you don't see this talked about as much, but our neurological research proves that a person in this age range, oftentimes their brain is still developing. So being in this kind of situation can have lasting effects on the structure of your mind, which I know sounds crazy, but it is true. I'm not being hyperbolic. There's one last thing we should also talk about, and that's privacy violations in K-pop and abroad, because according to several social critics and columnists and researchers, this sexism, this misogyny that these stars, female stars in particular, but also males face, is a symptom of a larger problem in society. There's one researcher that really stood out, Mano Lee, is a K-pop columnist, and specifically talking about the problems that female K-pop stars face. Mano Lee says the following. Quote, a lot of Korean women can relate to the issues that female celebrities deal with. They have experienced it themselves. Many, she says, feel unsafe due to the pervasiveness of MOLKA, M-O-L-K-A, gender-based violence and victim shaming. And MOLKA is weird. It's a portmanteau. It's it comes from two Korean words, mole, which is Korean for secret, and ka, which is the word for camera. And so MOLKA means the illegal filming of women, and it is a huge problem.
And I mean, this doesn't pass unnoticed. I mean, there's been widespread outrage over this spy cam epidemic. In 2018, almost 6,800 cases of hidden camera crimes were reported in the Supreme Prosecutor's Office. And in some cases, camera were actually hidden in women's public toilets and also motel rooms. Others involved things like filming and sharing videos of women that had been taken by their partners and former partners. It's almost like revenge porn kind of stuff that we think of in the States, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's one other thing I want to add. I don't know if people have heard about this. I don't know how widely this is being reported in the U.S., but I came across this when I was doing this Strange News Daily show. There was recently a huge scandal related to this. It's based on something called the Nth Room, N-T-H. And don't dive into it unless you have a strong stomach. But essentially what happened is a group of terrible, terrible dudes started blackmailing women, several of whom were minors, in South Korea, and forcing them to film themselves doing very dehumanizing things. up to and including self-harm, sexual assault, and incest, and then charging other people to, like, they called them tickets, to go into the messaging group Telegram, go into what they call these nth rooms, and watch these videos. One of the main guys got caught. Several of the other ones are still out there. And one of the big conversations in South Korea now is about prosecuting the people, the thousands of people who paid to watch these horrible things. That story's ongoing. We don't have an answer, but that just shows us that this this illicit filming epidemic is huge. It's bigger than K-pop. And, you know, not a lot of things are, but there is just so much disturbing and dark stuff here. This is just scratching the surface, you know? And remember, we're talking about a profoundly powerful industry. This is one that is more than capable of, in many cases, of protecting its own. You know what I mean? How much would an unscrupulous mover and shaker in this industry get away with? You could scapegoat K-pop stars all along, but where are the big names going down? You know what I mean?
Well, and they certainly haven't had their Me Too movement yet over there. You know, I mean,
well, it's happening right now.
Yeah,
it really is. It's beginning to happen, and the nth room case is one of the big things. There are a lot of students that are speaking out now, who are, you know, the trainees, the ones going in doing that like 10-year stint, right, that we were talking about. There have been several groups who have stood up and said, hey, there are allegations of sexual abuse, allegations of physical abuse, and they are just coming forward and trying to get support while still existing in this rigid system.
It is a shame. And, you know, this is where we leave off on today's episode, but we have to be fair. Currently, K-pop continues to grow. People love it, and heck, they should. You know, it's catchy. It's a lot of fun. You know, the music, if you're just listening to music and you're a kid, you know, it's stuff you can dance to. And this is also absolutely, absolutely not to imply that K-pop itself is rotten to the core. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are working ardently, day in, day out, and honestly, to make it in this industry. We all know entertainment's a brutal industry. And yes, there is a great deal of disturbing behavior under the surface or behind the curtain or whatever phrase you want to use. People in power are leveraging their authority to force performers to commit sex acts, to force them to live in virtual poverty, driving them to suicide, probably not purposely, but still driving them to suicide, and more. But to that point, at the, like, near the top of the show, the music industry is the music industry is the music industry.
So, is the entertainment industry.
Right. So we have to warn anyone who's too quick to criticize South Korea's industry, lest you be quick to hop on a high horse. Remember, many, many entertainment industries across the world are in a glass house situation. You know what I mean? We have to look at our own music industries. I mean, God knows the stories from the U.S. music industry alone. You know what I mean? There aren't enough trees to make the pages we would need to write down those scandals. For instance, you know, we've even got a podcast on our network that's dedicated entirely to this. It's called Disgraceland. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, Noel?
Yeah, sure. It's a show hosted by a really talented writer, producer named Jake Brennan. And every episode is just about, you know, musicians doing terrible things, getting caught up in scandals, largely of their own making. So it's definitely an interesting one. You got things, everything from Jerry Lee Lewis murdering several of his wives and getting away with it to, you know, Tupac Shakur story, to there's a rapper by the name of Big Lurch who ends up involved in some light cannibalism, and things like that. It's a really interesting show, and he's in the midst of season 4, I believe, right now.
Hey, another new show you should be checking out is called Strange News Daily. If you like this show, you're going to love this one. It's a quick update on what's going on in strange news. Ben, you want to tell them about it?
Yeah, well, until this house of cards burns down, it's a quick, I'd say 5 to 15 minute look, daily update at some of the stories that haven't made the news. Like, it turned out that all the Dead Sea Scroll fragments in the Museum of the Bible are fake. They're forgeries. We talked about updates that have happened really quickly. It comes out Monday through Friday, available wherever you find your favorite shows. And, you know, we want to hear from you because we know there are, statistically speaking, several of our fellow listeners have to be K-pop fans. The industry is just that huge. So we want to hear from you. What are some of your craziest K-pop fan or anti-fan stories? What's your favorite group and why? What allegations have you heard? What do you think the future of K-pop is? Tell us. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter.
Yes, we are Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook, Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. We have a phone number. It is 1-833-STDWYTK. You can leave us a message, tell us what you think about this episode, give us suggestions for others, make us laugh, tell us something interesting about yourself or your Aunt Judy. Whatever you want to do, we're interested. Give us a call.
Yes, give us a call. Let us know what you think. Reach out. And you know what? I'm going to say, because everybody needs these human moments nowadays, you don't have to have an interesting story. If you've got something Reddit would call mildly interesting, all right, lay it on us.
Yeah, or just tell us how you're getting through this whole thing. If you got any tips, or just tell us how you're doing. That's totally awesome. And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, you can always send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.